Let all things be done decently and in order. Let me explain something about the structure of the book of 1 Corinthians. Take a look at chapter 7, verse 1. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me. Paul is here in chapter 7 answering questions that have been raised by them. Chapter 7, verse 25. Now concerning virgins. So there was a question there that he was answering. 8:1. Now concerning things offered to idols. And then in 12:1. Now concerning spiritual gifts. So there's a major section of 1 Corinthians that is devoted to answering questions that had been raised. So Paul has put in a number of regulations in order to make it so that church services would have an orderliness rather than it becoming a free-for-all, which seems to be what was going on.
These are commands of necessity.
Right. Yeah.
Can you just maybe explain a little bit in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 what he's talking about and the examples he uses with the Old Testament there, John?
Sure. Yeah, this is starting at 10:1. He's looking back at the time of the Exodus. Starting at 10:1, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. You remember the pillar of cloud that was there to guide them during the day as they were going across the wilderness. And then there was the pillar of fire by night. So they were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. And all were baptized, I would take it as identified into Moses. Baptism does not always involve water. We see the word baptized, we think water. Mm-hmm. But it has a range of meaning. Because, after all, when they went through the sea, they didn't even get their feet wet. Mm-hmm. The picture here isn't that they were dunked within the sea. It's a figurative usage. And all ate the same spiritual food. So the manna was provided, the quail were provided, and all drank the same spiritual drink because water was provided by God in the wilderness for them. And they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. I remember there were two occasions, one in which Moses struck the rock once. Another time he was told to speak to the rock, and instead he whacked it twice. And he received discipline for that. The concept here is, Paul is saying they all enjoyed benefits provided by God. And here they are identified into Moses. All these things were setting them up in the right way, but they did not respond to that properly. So therefore, verse 5, but with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. And so there was discipline that was exercised upon the nation as they got into idolatry, and all sorts of things happened. And verse 6, now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And what Paul is here seeking to say, one of the city of Corinth had quite a reputation, so that one of the words for living a really licentious lifestyle was to Corinthianzo. To Corinthianize. And that was the worst debauchery that you could describe. And if someone used that term, it just said, this person has gone wild. And so there they are within that environment. And what Paul is saying is, just because you're believers, just because you have everlasting life, doesn't mean that automatically God is pleased with you, no matter what you do. And Paul has to have a number of very stiff exhortations and rebukes within this book. This is, shall we say, not the friendliest book that Paul wrote. Paul wrote to the Corinthians at least four letters. We see him referring back to an earlier writing of his back in chapter 5, verse 9. I wrote you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. And he goes on to explain that he's not saying, I'm not saying not to have contact with them because you need to be able to minister to people, but he's saying to make your associations, your close associations, that's not the appropriate thing to do. In 2 Corinthians, he refers to another letter that he wrote, and it's not this letter, and it's not 1 Corinthians. It was a problematic congregation, and Paul had a lot of correspondence with them because the problems just kept happening there within Corinth. And indeed, a lot of what's going on in the book of Romans is that he's seeking to prevent, in chapter 16, a repetition of what was going on in Corinth, because Paul wrote the book of Romans from Cenchrea, which is 7 miles away from Corinth. And so he was in Corinth ministering there and seeing all the problems there and trying to prevent similar problems from developing at Rome. Any other questions about portions that we've read since the last time we met? Basically, Corinthian epistles, ending of Romans, and start of Ephesians. You probably know Ephesians 1 pretty well, mm-hmm. I would assume.
Yes.
You want to tell
them kind of what we did? Sure. We've had two trips since the last time we were here. I flew on the 26th of October to Atlanta, Georgia, and then drove over to Columbia, South Carolina, and I spoke three times in a little town called Jenkinsville, South Carolina. Had a really neat opportunity for ministry there. And then I've had a meeting up in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then drove down to Atlanta. Saw a couple things I wanted to see. I saw, took pictures of, and I'll be able to show you at another time, a two-barreled cannon that's in Athens, Georgia. I have a suspicion that it probably killed more Confederates than it did Yankees. The idea was they were going to put a ball in each barrel, and it was going to have a chain attached. Then they were going to fire them simultaneously, but can you imagine what would happen if your timing was a little bit off? And they didn't have very good timing with their fuses. So I can just imagine that thing just whipping around and just doing everybody in that was anywhere near it. But then I went to Atlanta Airport, and I saw this woman coming out of the escalator, and she looked right at me and didn't see me, but I saw her. So Diane arrived, and then we went, and I was carrying 60 pounds of engineering books for George between the two of us. Most of them were in my suitcase, but then we went up to North Georgia, and I bought 60 pounds worth of theological books. Diane was really happy. And then we visited with George, and we went sightseeing with him and had a really good time. Met with the assistant pastor at his church. George is doing really well. And so he's seriously looking for work in his field. So it's going well. And we flew back. And most of you heard about our plane trip home. Diane picked out a seat. She was able to get on board before I did. And then I came along, sat next to her. And then the plane kept filling up. And there was a black lady that sat next to me and what looked like her husband. But the interesting thing is they came in and neither one of them made eye contact or anything with anybody. They seemed to be together, but they seemed to be apart. I mean, it was just an interesting thing. She sat down, and I got out of her that they were returning home to San Francisco. And she turned her body, and she was looking down basically at the floor. So it was obvious that she didn't want any conversation. So I thought, well, that's interesting. And I prayed, Lord, if there's any way this be able to minister here, you're going to have to open the door here. About halfway through the flight, she started sobbing, and she sobbed for a whole hour. She was still faced away from me. And I was praying, Lord, help me figure out what to do here. It was obvious she, no contact with anybody. So I finally reached out with living water, and my tray table is here. I just kind of reached over just a little bit on her side. She took it, gave me an acknowledgement just with her face, and then she put it down between her knees, just held it closed between her knees. I thought that was an interesting response. And then after a while, she started reading. And then we landed. She stood up. She was very tall. And her husband stood up. And they were both facing forward. No contact with each other. And it was still a very puzzling demeanor to me.
Hands. I remember she was holding his hands.
Yeah, sure. But then she reached out with her cell phone and showed Diane and me a picture of her son who was in his early teens, and she said, we just came back from the funeral. He was killed by a hit and run driver. And so I reached into my then I asked her, what's his name? I didn't say what is or what was, but I said, what's his name? So she said, Antoine. And I didn't catch her name. She said it, but I didn't want to press on that. So then I reached into my briefcase and said, this is for your husband. So I gave living water. He looked, he turned around and made an acknowledgement. That was the extent of communication. There wouldn't have been anything that could have been said. Living water was the only way that it was going to be possible to minister in that situation. Have no idea what their names are. Don't know if they're believers. Don't know anything. But the Lord knows who they are. And I would appreciate your prayers for this couple. They obviously are in a tremendous amount of hurt. I mean, that just was obviously just a crushing experience that they had. And but I trust that God will use his word either to comfort them, reassure them, or perhaps to help them come to believe in Jesus Christ for everlasting life. So
It's interesting to me when we interact with other people or we see them, we don't always know what's going on in their lives, We look and a person may have a certain appearance or a certain demeanor, And we may, in our mind, draw conclusions about these people without fully understanding what's going on. And your story reminds me of a rather important quote that I try to keep close, is that you will hold no man with enmity if you truly understand their story, or truly know their story. And I think it's important. It's just I think it's amazing how you sat there, and your primary focus was to look for an opportunity to minister. And I think it's just a reminder that we need to have that focus more when we interact with people on planes, at work, wherever.
Okay, we've got a short enough lesson in Ephesians that I thought we would do two messages tonight. So let's start with "Let this cup pass from me." You'll notice in the middle of the page that I have Jesus' first prayer recorded in Matthew, in Mark, and in Luke. This passage has caused a lot of consternation for people, because when Jesus is saying, "Let this cup pass from me," doesn't it sound like he's trying to escape the cross? Mm-hmm. He is not. So the passage is going to need to have a little bit of explanation. Jesus repeatedly, through his ministry, predicted his crucifixion and resurrection. The earliest one of those passages is in John chapter 2, verse 19, where he told Judeans, "Destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." But Jesus continually predicted his crucifixion and resurrection through each of the gospel books. The first synoptic passion prediction is in Matthew 16:21, paralleled by, so when you see the two slash marks, that's a handy way to say paralleled by, Mark 8:31 and Luke 9:22. Then he had a second passion prediction. The passages are listed there. And a third passion prediction. Jesus has made it very clear that he must die on the cross, and he will be resurrected. There's no optionality about it. This is going to happen. So it would seem very strange for Jesus, the night before he's crucified, for him to be saying, "Father, if you could let me off the hook, I'd sure appreciate it." He knows that it's part of the plan. He knows that it needs to happen. Now, furthermore, Matthew chapter 20, verses 22 to 23, and Mark 10, 38 to 39, use the imagery of drinking the cup to refer to Jesus' crucifixion. This language anticipates the wording in his prayers at Gethsemane. In light of this, one would not expect him in the Garden of Gethsemane to request being allowed to avoid the cross. Yet that is exactly how most interpreters approach the Gethsemane prayers. In Gethsemane, Jesus prayed 3 times that the Father would remove the cup from him. Okay, I'm glad I've got this cup. I had an empty cup, and I had it there for a reason, but really, this will work fine.
I was clear on
this. I was looking and saying, So he prayed 3 times that the Father would remove the cup from him. Now, the ones that are in italics, we don't have the words that he used. But the first prayer is recorded by all three, and then Matthew records what he said in his second prayer. Mark says that he prayed a second time. Luke says he prayed a second time. Matthew indicates he prayed a third time, but the last three passages I mentioned do not say what exactly he prayed, although it does say that he prayed the same thing. Let's consider the first, Jesus' first prayer is recorded in all three synoptics. Oh, my Father, in Matthew, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. In Mark 14:36, Abba, which means Father, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. And Luke 22:42, Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. The wording in Matthew and Luke use conditional statements. They both say if. But it's a first-class condition. First-class condition is stating it under the assumption that it is true. If, and it's assumed to be true, that it is possible for this cup to pass. If, and it's assumed to be true, that it is the Father's will to remove the cup. As you can tell, I'm not going in the same direction that most people go on this passage. I believe that it was the Father's will to remove the cup. But we need to look at this a little closer to see how it works. The wording in Matthew and Luke use conditional statements, if it is possible, if it is your will. But both are first-class conditions, using I plus the indicative mood, assuming that it is actually possible for the Father to remove the cup. Thus, in Matthew 26:39, it is assumed as possible for the cup to pass from Christ. Luke 22:42 assumes that it is the Father's will to take the cup away from him. Mark 14:36 explicitly states that all things, including taking away the cup, are possible for the Father. Indeed, Jesus' first prayer asserts the expectation that it is not only possible to take away the cup, but that it is the Father's will to take it away. Unfortunately, our finitude causes us at times to prematurely reject the right solution because we imagine a difficulty that is not really there. Our imagined difficulty is as follows, and I have it in italics. If it were possible to take away the cup from Jesus, would not the cross become optional? That's the conclusion that most people think it would lead to if it were assumed that the Father could and wanted to take away the cup. Cup does stand for the cross. But no, this is an imaginary conundrum. And now I'm on page 2. Matthew 26:42, that's the second prayer. And Matthew is the only one who records the second prayer. Matthew 26:42 shows that Jesus asked not to avoid the cross, which is depicted in the middle with the cross that is crossed out. But he asked to drink that cup sooner rather than later. Here's the picture. If I say, take away this cup from me, am I telling you whether I'm planning to drink it or whether I'm not planning to drink it? Well, I would like to drink it before you take it. And that's what Jesus is praying for. Take the cup away, but allow me to drink it first. Notice the wording. Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done. He's not praying for it to be taken away before he goes to the cross. He is saying, don't make me wait a long, 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 long time before I go to the cross. Let me take my medicine, get it over with, and be done with it.
So the cup specifically represents suffering?
Yes, the drinking of the cup is going to be the cross.
Why is that if there, John? It seems like the if should not be in
it. It's if, and it's assumed to be true. You might paraphrase it, since.
Okay, since the cup cannot pass from me.
Right. So the concept here would be... if it's cold outside, you better put your coat on. Well, I happen to know that it's cold outside. So I'm saying you want to grab your coat. If does not automatically assume that it's open-ended, not knowing where things are going. And Greek is able to express if differently.
Okay.
So there is a if that is expressed with the word I plus the indicative, or you can have eon plus the subjunctive. So there were different ways of expressing if. You could say if and it's assumed to be true, if it's assumed not to be true, or if and maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Each one of these is under an assumption standpoint. It's not guaranteed that it will work out the way that it's stated. But the way that it is stated here, if, and I'm assuming it to be true.
So your pictures here, the cup is synonymous with the cross.
Right.
And the no cross was never an option.
That, he wasn't talking about that. He's saying, let me drink this cup. Let me get this done with. Let it pass with me drinking it. Rather than... let it pass without me drinking it. Sherry, you had a question.
Well, I was trying to find if that if, was it eon or was it...
This is I.
It's I?
Yeah. So it's assumed to be true. So, then Matthew 26:42 clarifies that Jesus expects the cup to be taken away after he drinks of it, not before. He says, if this cup cannot pass away unless I drink it. Or shall we say, since this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, let me drink it and then take it away. And so this is a prayer about timing. He's saying, let me do this quickly. Don't drag this out. This is already taking a long time. But he says, even if your timetable is longer than what I would like, I'm going with your timetable. But the quicker, the happier I'll be. When he went to the cross, he drank of it, as Matthew 20, verses 22 and 23, and Luke 10, 38 to 39, used the imagery of drinking the cup for standing for his crucifixion. Yes, it was the Father's will to take away the cup after he went to the cross. In essence, we can understand the prayers in Gethsemane to say, Father, please expedite the cross so that the cup can be quickly taken away from me, but do all things on your timetable, not mine. This interpretation agrees with John 12, 27 to 28a, shortly before Gethsemane and shortly before his crucifixion, Jesus refuses to ask the Father to spare him from the hour of crucifixion. He said, now my soul is distressed, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But for this reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. He's saying, I'm not going to ask that because I came here to earth for this purpose. So why would we expect him in the cross to say, Father, let me out, let me escape going to the cross? He's been predicting that it had to happen.
Would you suspect that one of the reasons the more common presentation of this passage is because of the way English works. We tend to view if as really, we don't view if as a certainty.
Sure.
You know, in our language, you know, if you say if it's cold outside, that's probably a bad analogy because we're in Denver and it's November. But you know, there are some things that when we use the term if,
sure,
it is definitely not a certainty. We don't really know. You know, it's more of a almost like a contingency or something. You know?
Sure.
You know, so I think that probably that's probably the main reason why we get this.
That is an issue, but essentially, I think people have looked at it as, well, since he says the Father's will and his will might not be the same, but that is handled by, Father, you can do it on your timetable. I'm going to go with your timetable, even if it's not the timetable I want. Because this, the timetable is also in the Father's hands. So, the sooner he would face the cross, the sooner it would be over. As Hebrews 12:2 says, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. It is saying that Jesus anticipated the results of the cross, and he went there willingly. Jesus willingly submitted to the Father and willingly put our interests ahead of his own. Who benefited because he went to the cross? Well, we definitely did. He submitted to the Father and submitted his interests to our own. Now, finishing this out, please note how hollow an exhortation would emerge from the typical interpretation of this passage. Right before Jesus supposedly tries to escape the cross, a misunderstanding of this passage, he warns the disciples that they will stumble this very night. Matthew 26:31, Mark 14:27, and compare Luke 22:31-32. And he urged them to pray that they might not yield to temptation. Matthew 26:41, Mark 14:38, Luke 22:46. Yet they slept. Cthudo, and remember how we talked about the difference between cthudo and koimao, that cthudo is talking about believers that are not really alert and thinking about the things of the Lord. In Matthew 26:43, Mark 14:37, Luke 22:44, 45 and 46. I mean, if Jesus says, pray that you don't enter into temptation, then he's saying, Father, will you let me off the hook? I really don't want to go there. It would be a hollow exhortation to his disciples. But on the other hand, he knows that he's facing the cross. And what he's praying for is the Father to expedite things, for it to happen quickly. He's not praying to escape it. And in that light, it reinforces to his disciples, they're going to be facing a lot of difficulties, and he's saying, pray for the Father to strengthen you. But if he is praying, Father, you know, I really don't want to do what you want to do. Please let me out of it. And then he says, but you guys, make sure you pray for the Father to strengthen you to do what he wants you to do.
That's how I've always understood that verse, is that he really didn't want to take the cup. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a totally different picture of this passage. This concept of Jesus sacrificing himself for us willingly sets up for us to understand, or have a little bit more insight into the passage in Ephesians that we're going to consider. See, I said we'd have two short Bible studies.
And so, John, we also have in 3:15 and two other places where he says he must be lifted up,
yeah,
so that all might be saved. He
right.
understands this is...
Absolutely. Yeah, John. So it's the common understanding, I don't think, deals with the particulars of the text well. They make a certain sense of it, but then they create a real conundrum that doesn't need to happen. I think the passage itself points us in a different direction. Yes, Mark.
Now, it's a little confusing to me, because if Jesus is praying to expedite the cross, but that's not to be interpreted, he's doing that for his own good, to avoid suffering.
No.
To expedite the cross for our good, so sin won't be in the picture.
Okay, expedite. He's saying, don't make me wait for a week or a month. I'd like to have the cross tomorrow.
Yeah, but for our good, not to avoid suffering on his own part.
Right, well, he wasn't trying to avoid the suffering. He was praying that he be allowed to go to the cross sooner rather than later.
Because he knew the big picture of the cross. After the cross, then sin is not in the equation anymore, correct?
Right, right.
So he knew that the sooner that happened, the better off mankind would be.
Okay, sure,
So it's like, what is the motivation?
That's fair enough. The picture that we get in Luke is that he is sweating great, like as drops of blood. I mean, he's going through tremendous agony there, and he is not enjoying having this stretched out. What happened was the previous Monday, this is a Thursday night, the previous Monday was the point that the prophecy of Daniel in Daniel chapter 9 reached its climax, where it said after the end of the 69th heptad that the Messiah would be cut off. And so he has had to wait from Monday to Tuesday to Wednesday to Thursday. And he's saying, it's all clear. I can go to the cross. Let's get this over with. Let's get it accomplished. Okay, now let's look at Ephesians. That's our main passage, but I thought this would be a nice prelude to looking at Ephesians. Back in the book of Genesis, we find that God is the one who instituted marriage. God is the one who instituted family. God is the one who created humanity. God is the one who created the universe. And yet, here we are in 2014, and we have man trying to reinvent what marriage is. And we have man trying to reinvent what family is. We have man trying to say that, no, there wasn't a God who created the universe. Man is living in great rebellion, and one of the problems is when humanity at large gets pretty wild, the church also tends to move away from the truth. This passage has some things that are definitely not the way that people generally would like to see things. But notice the title, Sense versus Nonsense of Mutual Submission. And you notice the two arrows with the A and the B. This passage falls right on the heels of Ephesians 5:21. Notice what 5:21 says. Submitting to one another in the fear of God. One another, I take very seriously. I believe that Paul is setting up in that verse right there, verse 21, the overall concept that is going to guide our interpretation all the way from 5:22 to 6:9. Now look at 5:22. Wives. Then verse 25. Husbands. Notice that Paul has a lot more to say to husbands than he does to wives. Then look at 6:1. Children. And as you drop down to verse 4, and you fathers. Then in 6:5, bondservants. And verse 9, and you masters. So Paul has arranged this whole section, 5:22 through 6:9, of wives, husbands, children, parents or fathers, slaves, and masters. And through this whole section, I will argue that he is talking about mutual submission. Now, we're all very familiar with teaching that says that what Paul is saying is wives are supposed to submit to husbands, children are supposed to submit to parents, and slaves are to submit to masters. But I will argue that this is truly one another. And as we look at this passage, it's going to have a way that wives are to submit to husbands, but there will be a way that husbands submit to wives. It's not an identical way, but there is a way within this passage that submission goes both directions. It's to one another. Both directional. Children have a way that they are to submit to parents, and there is a different way that parents are to submit to their children. Slaves are to submit to their masters, but there is a different way in which masters are to submit to their slaves. So when he says one another, I take it that he means one another. So that's what I mean when I have that pair of arrows in the upper right side of that page. And what we're going to see through this evening is going to prepare us for when, after the new year, when we return into Ephesians, my plan is that for the remainder of times that we get together, it will be things concerning Thanksgiving, concerning Christmas. So we'll be doing some specials rather than continuing through Ephesians here as we finish out the year. So we'll be returning to Ephesians next year, but this is kind of setting overall picture for the concept. The word translated one another is allelois. It comes from the word allelone. It is part of our word parallel. Para means beside, allelone means one another. So when you have parallel lines, you have lines that are beside each other. And so each other means each other. And so it's the concept there in 5:21 is one another. It's bidirectional. Now, as we noticed, we have husbands, wives, parents, children, masters, slaves. So Paul speaks of mutual submission. What does he mean? Paul gives three sets of overlapping relationships. What do I mean by overlapping relationship? Well, a person could be a husband, a parent, and a slave. Someone could be a not a husband or a wife, a single person, and a child, who is of a slave-holding family. Now, there end up being all sorts of ways that these go together. Now, having been an economics major in my undergraduate work, I took a lot of statistics and so on and so forth, and were able to predict that there will be 8 patterns here if each one of the items is used in each occasion. So you can have husband, parent, master, husband, parent, slave, husband, child, master, husband, child, slave, wife, parent, master, wife, parent, slave, wife, child, master, wife, child, slave. This is assuming that we have multiple generations in a household, so that if we have grandparents and so on and so forth. So, one of the problems, though, is there are some people who are neither husband nor wife. Some people lack intergenerational relationships. That is, their parents are dead and they don't have any children. And some people are free but don't own slaves. So when we start putting all of those in, it creates 27 generic combinations. You can work through those on your own if you're curious. I won't take the time to go through them all, though I took the time to type them all out. And the eight that are listed above are marked 1 through 8. But as you can see, there are 17 others that are, or no, 19 others that were not covered. So what's the big point about this final chart and all these statistics? Well, consider combination W, which is in bold and underlined. Here we have an unmarried person, whether male or female, and
child.
Yeah, actually, I think that was supposed to be a CA, but yes, it was supposed to be a CA, which would be childless single head of household or childless adult. And that was a typographical error. And the person is slave, but I obviously meant X, but oh well. Anyway, I was trying to picture someone who was outside of the eight relationships. I think you get the picture, even though I was sleepy when I was doing this, and it didn't end up, my fingers didn't go where I thought they were going to go on the keyboard. First question we have to ask is, does submit equal obey? It does not. It can include obey, but it is not equal to obey. Exhorting children to obey their parents makes sense. But can we make exhorting, would Paul be saying for parents to obey their children? Well, some of our social theorists that are walking around the countryside these days would say yes. But obviously, that's not what Paul was aiming at.
No.
So I will argue that submit does not equal obey. It can be with that as the idea. But it is not equal to that as the idea. How do we introduce that? Remember how when I talked about how Jesus Christ was not trying to avoid the cross? He was looking to the cross, but he was saying, "Let me go there quickly." He was looking out for the Father's interests, and he was looking out for our interests. He submitted his own personal interests to those of the Father and to those of us. We would say that we should obey Christ. We should be in submission to him. But did he not willingly submit to our interests? That's the point. He didn't obey us, but he submitted to our interests. He put our interests ahead of his own interests. And within this passage, what Paul is doing is he is showing how the exhortations of the previous section actually look in interpersonal relationships. Where he has been aiming believers has been for them to seek to please God. not to be running at odds with God. And look at where he went in the passage that was immediately before this one. Starting at verse 15. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. Wise people are ones who know what the Bible says and are seeking to use the Bible in order to please God. Therefore, and do not be drunk with wine, which is dissipation. He's saying, being drunk with wine is counterproductive. But instead, be filled by the Spirit. But what is the Spirit supposed to fill us with? His Word. We are to allow the Holy Spirit to fill us with His Word. That doesn't happen by osmosis, but by us laying our head on the pillow and putting the Bible on top of our head. It happens by us spending time in the Word, spending time being taught the Word, meditating on the Word, and praying that God will help us to use His Word in our lives. Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. This is talking about ministry towards one another that is Word-based. Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs are different types of psalms. Within the Psalter, these are terms that are used to describe the different psalms. Singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another in the fear of God. And say, okay, that sounds good. What does it look like? And in this passage, Paul shows what it looks like in three types of relationships. Marriage, family, master, slave. So Paul is illustrating how it works. But as we pointed out, there are 27 possibilities as we just look at these relationships. And here we are in the United States. There's no such things as masters and slaves. Paul isn't saying we're off the hook because we have an employer. Or we're off the hook because we have a professor. Paul is talking about how we are to conduct ourselves with other believers. He's talking about the way that the things that he has told us at a theoretical level, this is what it looks like. So we shouldn't be looking at this and saying, well, this doesn't apply to me, and this doesn't apply to me, and this doesn't apply to me, and well, I'm off the hook. Hey, this is nice. What we should be doing instead is asking ourselves, how do we apply these types of things to the relationships that we find ourselves in? And that's going to include more than just the three relationships that he described. So, we can understand pretty easily how one who has less authority in a relationship would submit to one in a position of greater authority. The body of Christ is to submit to its head, Christ. Look at verses 23 and 24 in this context. For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. And the body here is talking about the body of Christ, the church. He's talking about that body which includes both Jews and Gentiles that have believed in Jesus Christ for everlasting life. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything. So he's saying it has a certain way that it works out, that the church has certain relationships of obedience to Christ, and he says that that has a practical extension then with regard to a wife to her husband. Besides that, though, if we look at verse 27, we see that Christ, let's see, we'll back up a little bit. verse 25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, initial purpose, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word. Second purpose that happens later, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having any spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. He's clearly pointing to there are certain things within the marital relationship that bear resemblance to what Jesus Christ has done and is doing and will do for the church. And then we have verse 33b, where he says that the wife is to see that she respects her husband. Now, this section right here, obviously within our current climate, our society, is a very controversial one. So the point is, of course, rejected by many feminists as chauvinistic, but they fail to see that properly applied, mutual submission safeguards everyone. When we think about it, if Jesus Christ had not gone to the cross, had not paid our death penalty, what kind of plight would we be in? Mutual submission, where Christ isn't just saying, you know, they're all supposed to serve me, but he's looking and saying, what can I do for people, has brought about benefits for us. In the marriage relationship, the responsibility that the wife has towards the husband is balanced out by the responsibility that the husband has to the wife. And the proper response of the slave to the master is balanced out by the proper response that the master is to have to the servant. In each case, when mutual submission is being followed, it safeguards everyone. And that's the direction that this passage is going. So when people pick and choose and they say, I like this part, but I don't like this part. I like this part, but I don't like that part. What they're doing is they're tearing at the logic of the passage, and they are ultimately undoing the safeguards that were designed to protect them. Because they say, I can't trust this. I can't trust what God says. I've got to protect myself. And in the process, the whole passage gets turned on its head. We can obviously understand the expectation of children to obey parents and to honor them. And it obviously makes sense that that would be what he would encourage for the slaves to their masters. After all, how many times does Paul call himself a bondservant of Jesus Christ? And what he's saying is he has a responsibility to serve Christ in the same way as a bondservant would have a responsibility towards his master. But now let's look where the arrows are pointing in the opposite direction. How does one who has greater authority submit to one with less authority? Well, it's very clear what Christ did. He sacrificed himself in our place, that he would pay for our death penalty, that he would be able to give us everlasting life, that he could cause us to grow, and that he could prepare us to be with him forever in heaven. His willing sacrifice of his own interests has benefited us greatly. But now let's look at the responsibility of the husband to the wife. That comes out here in several passages here within this section. Notice in verse 25, husbands, love your own wives sort of, kind of, a little bit like just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. He's talking here about how Jesus gave up his life for the benefit of the church. It's often easier to look at the one heroic time of giving one's life to protect his wife or his children. But Paul isn't just talking about the heroic situation where something comes up and you may even lay down your life and die on the spot protecting your spouse. He's here urging husbands towards a daily self-sacrifice. Isn't that funny? Study a passage and then you get a test on it. And this week was a time where the Lord brought some reminders here on this passage for me. And that always happens. You know, you get into God's Word, and God's Word is designed to cut like a knife, and it does so. The husband has a very high responsibility because he has said just as. And the type of love that Christ has manifested for the church was a sacrificial love. One in which he not only sacrificed his life, but he sacrificed his own interests in the interests of those who would believe. Looking a little further in the passage, verse 26, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word. This is not talking about baptism. It's talking about a water-type washing that takes place through the word. Husbands have a responsibility as spiritual head of the household to keep the word of God forefront within the church, or within the household, which means that the family, the wife and the children, are going to benefit, but the word has to be held up. And here, as Christ is seeking to bring about the church's growth in the word, sanctifying and cleansing her by a water-type washing that takes place through the word, husbands have a responsibility with regard to the communication of and application of the word within the household. But now drop down to verse 33a. Let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself. High standard. Very high standard. The standard is loving one's wife to the same degree as one loves himself. And we all love ourselves. We basically do what we think is in our self-interest. But it is in the husband's self-interest to put his wife's interest up there as if they were his own interests, because indeed they are. And parents, in verse 4 of chapter 6, have a responsibility not to exasperate their children by putting on them such requirements that they can't meet and they're always falling short, and as a result they're perpetually being stifled and not able to meet up with the standard and end up saying, I give up, and they start running a different direction. Parents have to be on guard against that. He says in particular here, fathers, but fathers can stand for both husband, father and mother. As in Spanish, where they say padres, fathers equals parents. It's same type of concept. And interestingly, look at what he says as he talks to the bondservants. To the masters. Verse 9 of chapter 6. And you, masters, do the same things to them. He's saying reciprocate one another. The exhortations that he gave to the bondservants, he's saying do the same things to them. Okay, so we have to look back. Verse 5, bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart as to Christ. I think the fear and trembling in sincerity of heart as to Christ is going to apply in how the bondservant is to deal with, the master is to deal with the bondservant. The bondservant is not just to do eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. Saying that rewards come not based on station in life, but based on that which has been done that is pleasing to God. And he is saying here to the masters, do the same things. What he's saying is, deal with them as an extension or in the same service of the Lord type of way. Giving up the threat, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven and there is no partiality with him. In each case, Paul is giving reason why submission should go in two directions. Submission doesn't equal obedience, but obedience is clearly part of the picture. But self-sacrificial love is also part of the picture. Looking out for the interests of the other person in the relationship is part of the picture. And doing it in a way that is serving the Lord and is in keeping with how the Lord served us and put our interests ahead of his own is part of the picture. So I think this passage, contrary to how it is normally approached, is teaching that submission goes in both directions. And I thought that looking at how Christ willingly went to the cross sets up very nicely for this passage. And so I knew that we would have two short lessons, that this one would be a very short one, so I figured putting in a second one would help to clarify that. So at this time, if we gather around the counter...
John, we'll, just one,
yeah, go ahead.
It seems to me another excellent illustration of this would be Jesus understands he's going to be leaving his disciples, and all of his focus is on preparing them for his departure and not what he's going to have to suffer through at the cross.
Absolutely. John 13 through 17 is very much focused on meeting the needs of the disciples so that they will be able to carry on, so that they will have something stabilized, so that his ministry will be carried on instead of them running in 100 directions. And yes, he's definitely more focused on them than upon himself. Any other questions about...
Just a quick question, Doug.
Yes.
Do you have the question marks on the arrows on the side going
down? What I was saying is people often puzzle over how these could be. That's all I was... And so the bi-directional one, I also have the question mark. This is quite regularly taught as submission is one direction and ignoring that this is really a fleshing out of what he said in 6:21.
It's interesting how we take that word submission as a negative in our world today. When it was God's design, and if you're submitting, you're concerned about benefiting others. And if everyone acted that way, it'd be as he planned it.
He's designed it so that the closer that we draw in a relationship between two people to him, the closer we end up becoming to each other as well.
And many women take that word as just totally offensive and negative.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the problems is because many men are not properly submitting in the relationships, and we equate that word to mean obey.
Right.
And with no other,
kind of lording over another person.
And I think that's what causes the contamination of the idea, because really what this is from going through this, and I appreciate your outline here, because it helps me realize that this isn't really just about husband and wives and children. This is about community. This is a recipe for a healthy and whole community. That's what this is. And if everyone is doing their part, it's so funny, even in my professional life, I'm looking at my corporation training us on the importance of servant leadership because it produces a healthy and functional workplace. It's the same idea. This started long before emotional intelligence. And so it's beautiful to see it laid out here that this is really a recipe for a healthy and whole community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a very helpful thing to look at the overall, all three passages in relation to 5:21 before diving into the details. Because most of the time we get into the details of it, and if we don't know where the passage is going, it's easy to get lost in the details. Mm-hmm. Diane?
I was just thinking with the husband and wife, but it could be in all the other relationships too. Mm-hmm. It's helping people through the word to rise to being rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole body.
Absolutely. When he talks to the bondservants, he specifically raises the issue of reward. And we tend to look at these passages in a certain way. And I remember Diane's father, almost all of you know Earl. he was talking to the pastor that was going to marry Diane and me. He said, "Now, you're going to say that she's supposed to obey him, aren't you?" And so he twitched me about that, and he says, funny, he didn't quite want to say it exactly that way. He knew about, the pastor that married us knew about the concept of mutual submission. So he knew that submission went both directions, and that as soon as it's rendered obey, people think this is only going in one direction. And this passage is far richer than most people give it credit for being. Any other questions? Yeah, like I said, you can work your way through those 27 possibilities, but concept there is Paul was not trying to be exhaustive, and I've heard so many people that say, well, he didn't say how I ought to view my employer. He said how I ought to approach him if he were my master, but he's not my master, so I can do whatever I want with him.
Well, that depends on how you define that.
Yeah, in most cases, what you're looking at within this context would be people who had sold themselves in order to pay off a debt, and after a certain length of time they would again be freed.
That's a very important distinction, because there are people that really confuse this point. There's no biblical idea of slavery based on the color of someone's skin,
right,
or anything like that. This was a very different type of slavery than what we commonly associate it with.
Absolutely.
Well, they would be free after the year of Jubilee.
Okay, but this is Gentile in the church, but essentially, once the debt had been satisfied, then they would be freed. At some point, we'll do a series on the book of Philemon, an absolutely fascinating book, and most people think that Paul is twisting the knife there with Philemon, because there's one verse that's badly mistranslated in Philemon, just horribly mistranslated. And I'll even read the passage that's horribly mistranslated. I won't tell you how it ought to be translated. We'll do that at a later point. This is a new Bible, so turning pages is still difficult. Let's see. Yes, verse 19 in Philemon sounds like Paul is sticking the knife in and twisting it and saying, I'm being nice while he's doing it. I, Paul, am writing with my own hand. I will repay. Not to mention that you, to you, that you owe me even your own self besides. And yet, what did he say before that? He said in verse 14, but without your consent, I wanted to do nothing, that your good deed might not be by compulsion, as it were, but voluntary. But if Paul is pressuring him, as it sounds like he's doing in verse 19, he's a two-handed preacher. You've heard about two-handed preachers. On the one hand, but on the other hand. And God doesn't want two-handed preachers. And Paul's message here is one where he is honestly saying, I'll even give you away the answer. The way that verse 19 ought to be rendered, I, Paul, am writing with my own hand, I will repay, that I not say to you that you owe me your own self besides. He's saying, I have pledged so that I will not appeal to anything based on debt that you have. Because what Paul wants from Philemon is he wants him to do more than what he's asking him to do. So he's got a certain amount he's asking, but he wants him to do more. And he tells us, he gives indication of what it is that he really is hoping for. But he's not seeking to pressure Philemon. He wants Philemon to reach the conclusion based on whether or not he regards Paul as his partner. If he regards Paul as his partner, then that will give a certain type of way that he will deal with Paul, and therefore deal with Onesimus. And when he says, if he owes you anything or has wronged you, since Onesimus owed money to Philemon and ran away without having settled that, he definitely owed. And Paul says, put it on my account, I'll pay. I'm good for it. It's a fascinating little book. And it ties in very nicely with the book of Colossians that was written at the same time to the same church.